Part 1. The Discipline of Desire. What it is proper to want or not to want. Chapter 3. Some things are in our power, others are not. We must make the best of those things that are in our power and take the rest as nature gives it. Epictetus, Discourses, Book 1, Chapter 1. I came to the United States back in 1990. I knew little of American culture, other than what could be gleaned growing up watching Hollywood movies and television series dubbed in Italian. And a close friend suggested that I start my informal education by reading a short novel by Kurt Vonnegut. Slaughterhouse-Five, published in 1969, is a strange work. The protagonist, Billy Pilgrim, finds himself abducted by an alien race known as the Tralfamadorians, or so he thinks, who put him in a zoo together with another captured Earthling, the porn star Montana Wildhack. The Tralfamadorians are capable of moving in four dimensions, the standard three in space, plus time, and so can revisit any moment of their lives as they wish. Billy picks up this trick from his captors and then uses it to narrate crucial moments in his life, including the controversial Allied bombing of Dresden near the end of World War II. It was while reading Slaughterhouse-Five that I first encountered these words, which are framed in Billy's optometry office on Earth and also inscribed in a locket worn by Montana. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. This, of course, is the Serenity Prayer, which encapsulates our hero's quest throughout the book. Billy very much wants serenity, and he thinks he can achieve it by recognizing that the past cannot be changed, that he can only affect the here and now. This recognition takes courage, not the kind needed in battle, but the more subtle and yet arguably more important kind needed to live your life to your best. The prayer in its modern form is attributed to Reinhold Niebuhr, an American theologian who used it in his sermons as early as 1934. Today it's best known because of its use in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and a number of other 12-step organizations. The same sentiment is detectable, however, across centuries and cultures. Solomon ibn Gabirol, an 11th-century Jewish philosopher, expressed it this way. And they said, at the head of all understanding is realizing what is and what cannot be, and the consoling of what is not in our power to change. Shantideva, an 8th-century Buddhist scholar, similarly wrote, if there is a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? And if there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? Yet there is an even more ancient version. Make the best use of what is in your power, and take the rest as it happens. Some things are up to us, and some things are not up to us. Our opinions are up to us, and our impulses, desires, aversions, in short, whatever is our own doing. Our bodies are not up to us, nor are our possessions, our reputations, or our public offices, or, that is, whatever is not our own doing. That one is found in Epictetus's Enchiridion, or Handbook, right at the beginning. Because this idea is foundational to Epictetus's teachings and crucial to the whole system of Stoic philosophy going back to Zeno, we begin our exploration of Stoicism by considering it in some detail. The parallels between these teachings hint that the influence of Stoic wisdom has been widespread, if often unrecognized, for many centuries. Moreover, some of the key concepts of Stoicism are found in other philosophical and religious traditions, including Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, and Taoism. Some of these parallels are the result of direct or indirect reciprocal influence, and others represent the independent convergence of wise minds reflecting on the human condition. Although this book is concerned primarily with Stoicism, we will repeatedly encounter ideas that have been proposed, rediscovered, and validated through practice by people living in very different times and cultures. Since these are ideas that have truly withstood the test of time, we would be wise to draw from them in our own lives. One day not so long ago, having recently reread Vonnegut's novel, I was walking in the Roman Forum and thinking about the words of my wise friend Epictetus when it occurred to me that there was a problem. He was both conceding too much and not enough. Epictetus lists our opinions, impulses, desires, and aversions as up to us, and the condition of our bodies, possessions, and reputations, and the public offices we hold as not up to us. That can't be right, I told him. On the one hand, my opinions are influenced by other people through what I read or hear or discuss. As for my impulses, desires, and aversions, many of them seem to spring up naturally and instinctively, and all I have available is some veto power when it comes to translating a thought into action. Confirming my thought, I was distracted at that very moment by some gorgeous-looking gelato in a shop window, but I didn't need it, and it wouldn't have been good for my waistline, so I refrained from getting it. On the other hand, I can certainly take care of my body by, say, going to the gym and eating healthy food. I can decide what to acquire within my financial limits, and my reputation is also something I can work on with colleagues, students, friends, and family. Moreover, even though I do not hold public office, the decision would certainly be mine if I were to seek it, as would my efforts to put myself forth as a candidate and work on a campaign to gather votes. I was in the midst of articulating all this to my Stoic master when I suddenly realized that my 21st century smugness had caught up with me. Of course Epictetus knew all this. He was no intellectual slouch. He must have meant something different from the literal reading of his words. I'm not sure why this surprised me, since all texts need to be interpreted against some background information. One needs guidance to provide some context, and luckily, I had the best one available right next to me during my walk in the forum. I asked him, "How do you make sense of my objection?" Epictetus's answer came, as it often does, by way of an analogy. "We act very much as if we were on a voyage. What can I do? I can choose out the helmsman, the sailors, the day, the moment. Then a storm arises. What do I care? I have fulfilled my task. Another has now to act, the helmsman. If the weather is bad for sailing, we sit distracted and keep looking continually and ask, what wind is blowing? The north wind. What have we to do with that? When will the west wind blow? When it so chooses, good sir." As is clear from Epictetus's example, the so-called Stoic dichotomy of control, some things are up to us, other things are not, is really a recognition of three levels of influence that we have over the world. To begin with, we make certain choices, selecting some goals, the sea voyage, and what appears to be the best means to obtain them, the experienced sailors. Next, we need to recognize that it does not follow from just having made a choice that we can implement a given course of action. Our preferred helmsman, for instance, may be sick on that day, or his services may be too expensive for us. Finally, some factors are entirely out of our control, and we cannot even begin to influence them, like the direction and intensity of the winds. As it happens, I experienced a harrowingly concrete case of Epictetus's analogy while writing this book. With one of my brothers, I flew from Rome to London to a festival of music and philosophy. A lot about that trip was under our control, our agreement to go, and our acceptance of the organizer's choice of airline, which supplied a specific plane and helmsman. What was entirely outside of our control was what happened as we were about to land at Gatwick Airport. We were close enough to the ground to distinctly see the landing strip when suddenly the plane's powerful engines roared and we felt a strong acceleration. The Airbus had abruptly halted its descent and was rapidly gaining altitude again. This was not a good sign, but the pilot played it cool. He came on the speaker system and told us that because of a traffic issue, we were going to turn around and resume the landing procedure. That turned out to be a euphemism for almost landing on top of a plane that was still on the runway we were supposed to use, apparently unnoticed by the control tower. Only the prompt reflexes of the pilot and the Airbus's powerful engines had saved our lives, neither of which factors, obviously, we had any means to affect. I only knew what was happening because my neighbor, sitting by the window, told me what was unfolding in real time. Yet throughout this incident, I felt strangely calm. I'd often wondered when something dangerous would happen during my travels. When it so chooses, good sir. The old philosopher was right again. One of Epictetus's crucial points is that we have a strange tendency to worry about and concentrate our energies on precisely those things we cannot control. On the contrary, the Stoics say, we should pay attention to the parameters in life's equation that we do control or influence, making sure that we have embarked on a voyage we really want to make, and for good reasons, spending some time researching the best crew, airline, for our ship, plane, and making related preparations. One of the first lessons from Stoicism, then, is to focus our attention and efforts where we have the most power, and then let the universe run as it will. This will save us both a lot of energy and a lot of worry. Another Stoic metaphor, from Cicero, may help illustrate the point. Consider an archer trying to hit a target. Cicero explains that the archer has a number of things under his control. He has decided how much to train and how intensely. He has chosen a bow and an arrow as a function of the distance and type of target. He has aimed as best he can. And he has chosen the exact moment when to let the arrow go. In other words, if he has been a conscientious archer, he has done his best up to the moment when the arrow leaves his bow. Now, the question is, will the arrow hit the target? That, very clearly, is not up to him. After all, a sudden gust of wind could alter the course of the arrow, which would then miss the target altogether. Or something else might unexpectedly interpose itself between the archer and the target, say, a carriage passing by. Finally, the target itself might move away to avoid the flying weapon, especially if the target is an enemy soldier. That is why Cicero concluded that the actual hitting of the mark is to be chosen, but not to be desired. A superficially cryptic statement whose meaning should by now be fairly clear. The Stoic archer has deliberately chosen to attempt to hit the mark, and he has done the best he can do within his power to accomplish the goal. But he is also ready to accept a possible negative outcome with equanimity, because the outcome was never entirely under his control. Other variables entered into it, just as happens in pretty much anything we decide to do. It was at this point during our conversation that I realized that what Epictetus was telling me had countless applications to my own life. Consider, for instance, the degree of control we have over our own bodies. Ever since I was little, I have struggled with my weight. I was a chubby kid, and predictably the subject of much teasing at school. I later developed into a somewhat insecure teenager, particularly when it came to personal relationships, and especially with girls. I've gotten better over time, but the weight issue is still with me, and always will be. Yet a Stoic perspective is very helpful here. To begin with, I had no control over either my genetic makeup, the result of a random encounter of one of my father's sperm with one of my mother's eggs, or, just as crucially, my early developmental environment. I ate whatever my grandparents, with whom I grew up, gave me, in whatever quantities and at whatever frequencies they deemed appropriate. As a biologist specializing precisely in the study of nature versus nurture, I cannot stress enough just how much our habits are shaped by the early interaction between our genes and the environment of our infancy and childhood. But this is no reason to give in to fatalism and helplessness. A critical part of growing up and maturing as an adult is asserting more control over one's life, including choices concerning what to eat and how much, whether to exercise and how diligently, and so forth. Thus, probably later than would have been ideal, but nonetheless with determination, I began exercising moderately more than 15 years ago, to maintain muscle tone and aerobic capacity. At approximately the same time, I also started reading about the basics of nutrition, paying attention to food labels, and generally trying to eat well and in moderation. I probably still slip in these habits more often than I'd like to admit, but their results have been clearly on the positive side. I am healthier, and I look better, which in turn helps me feel psychologically better. But I still do not have, and will never have, the kind of slim and muscular body that for others is a natural gift, or that they are able to achieve through their own strenuous efforts, facilitated by their genetics and early development, of course. This used to be a nagging problem and source of frustration for me. No more. I now have internalized the stoic attitude that I have control over some things, what I eat, whether to exercise, but not others, my genes, my early experiences, and a number of other external factors, including the efficacy of my exercise regimen. So the outcome, the body that I have, the degree of health that I enjoy, is to be accepted with equanimity. It is chosen but not desired, as Cicero put it. I derive satisfaction from knowing that, quite irrespective of the actual outcome, I'm doing my best. The Stoic dichotomy of control applies throughout our lives. Let's say you are up for a promotion at your job. You think it is reasonable that you will get it, given how many years you have been with the company, the quality of your performance reviews, and your good relationships with your coworkers and your boss. Suppose you are going to find out tomorrow whether you got the promotion or not. Adopting a stoic approach will allow you to have a night of peaceful sleep beforehand and be ready in the morning to face whatever outcome comes your way, not with resignation, but with confidence. Your confidence lies not in the outcome, however, for that is outside of your control. The outcome depends on too many variables, including the internal politics of your company, your boss's personal sympathy, or not, toward you, and how much competition you may have from colleagues. No, your confidence lies in knowing that you did whatever was in your power to do, because that, and only that, is under your control. The universe doesn't bow to your wishes. It does what it does. Your boss, your coworkers, the shareholders of your company, your customers, and a number of other factors are part of the universe. So why would you expect them to do your bidding? Or imagine you are a parent with a teenage daughter who has suddenly turned against you, despite a happy childhood and what you thought was a wonderful relationship. The normal reaction might be regret, for perhaps not having done everything possible when your daughter was younger, despite the fact that you can't really think of what else you might have done. You also feel powerless to control the situation, and frustrated by your previously happy child simply not responding to you anymore, even seeming, at least momentarily, to despise you. Epictetus tells us that regret is a waste of our emotional energy. We cannot change the past. It is outside of our control. We can, and should, learn from it, but the only situations we can do something about are those happening here and now. The right attitude is to derive comfort from the knowledge that you did your best in raising your daughter. Indeed, that you are still doing your best to help her through this difficult moment in her life. Whether you succeed or not, your level-headed acceptance of the outcome will be best. Notice that I am not counseling resignation. Stoicism is too often misinterpreted as a passive philosophy, yet resignation goes precisely against not just what the Stoics themselves said, but also, more importantly, what they practiced. The Stoics we know of were teachers, politicians, generals, and emperors, hardly the sort of people who would have fallen into a fatalistic torpor. Rather, they were wise enough to make the distinction between their internal goals, over which they had control, and the external outcome, which they could influence but not control. As the Serenity Prayer says, it is the hallmark of a mature and wise person to realize that difference. I keep another famous story of Stoic equanimity in mind whenever I find myself in difficult circumstances, which, luckily for me, are usually far less challenging than those faced by the protagonist of the story. Paconius Agrippinus was a first-century Stoic whose father had been put to death by the Emperor Tiberius, allegedly for treason. In the year 67 CE, Agrippinus faced the same accusation, probably also unjustified, from another emperor, Nero. Epictetus recounts what unfolded. News was brought to him, "Your trial is on in the Senate. Good luck to it, but the fifth hour is come." This was the hour when he used to take his exercise and have a cold bath. "Let us go and take exercise." When he had taken his exercise, they came and told him, "You are condemned." "Exile or death?" he asked. "Exile." "And my property?" "It is not confiscated." "Well then, let us go to Aricia and dine." Agrippinus's reaction may sound cocky, the sort of thing an unflappable hero in a Hollywood movie, perhaps played by Cary Grant or Harrison Ford, might say. but unlikely to ever be uttered by an actual human being. And yet, this is precisely the power of Stoicism. The internalization of the basic truth that we can control our behaviors but not their outcomes, let alone the outcomes of other people's behaviors, leads to the calm acceptance of whatever happens, secure in the knowledge that we have done our best given the circumstances. Incidentally, a friend of Agrippinus's, the senator and Stoic, Publius Clodius Thrasius Petus, was also accused by Nero's sycophants and was not so lucky. He was given the liberum mortis arbitrium, a free choice of death, as the Romans euphemistically put it. He was ordered to commit suicide. Accordingly, he turned to his dining companions and calmly excused himself, retired to his bedroom, and invited the quaestor who had brought the emperor's orders to witness while he slit his veins. He then awaited his death while conversing with his friend Demetrius, a philosopher of the rival school of the Cynics, about the nature of the soul. Agrippinus and Thrasia were obviously rather exceptional human beings, and thankfully many of us don't live under the rule of a capricious tyrant. Though, unfortunately, such leaders are still surprisingly common 2 millennia after Nero. What is important is the basic idea of the dichotomy of control and its implications. If we take this notion seriously, it turns out that most things are not really under our control, from small and insignificant matters to really important ones. The logical consequence of this realization, which is also endorsed by Buddhism and other philosophical and religious traditions, should be to practice non-attachment to things and people. This is a tricky idea, and another source of common misconceptions about Stoicism. Here is how Epictetus rather bluntly explained it to me. I later realized that he meant to momentarily stun me in order to allow my mind to open up a bit and entertain a notion that had been alien up to that point. What, then, is the proper training for this? In the first place, the principal and most important thing, on the very threshold, so to speak, is that when you are attached to a thing, not a thing which cannot be taken away, but anything like a water jug or a crystal cup, you should bear in mind what it is, that you may not be disturbed when it is broken. So should it be with persons. If you kiss your child or brother or friend, you must remind yourself that you love a mortal, and that nothing that you love is your very own. It is given you for the moment, not forever, nor inseparably, but like a fig or a bunch of grapes at the appointed season of the year, and if you long for it in winter, you are a fool. So, too, if you long for your son or your friend when it is not given you to have him, know that you are longing for a fig in wintertime. Pause for a minute and reread that passage before continuing. Like most people, I am sure you can go along with what Epictetus says about attachment when he is talking about jugs and crystal cups. Sure, of course there is no need to get attached to objects, even though a lot of us actually are. After all, it is just a cup, or an iPhone, and it's no big deal if it breaks, even if it is an expensive cup. There is no such thing as an inexpensive iPhone. But a good number of us recoil in horror when the philosopher shifts his discourse to our own child, brother, or friend. How inhuman, you might say, to advise people not to care about their loved ones. What sort of sociopath could possibly make an analogy between my brother and a fig, whether in or out of season? And yet, once I had time to reflect on it for a moment, I saw that Epictetus was not counseling me not to care for my loved ones, and moreover, that he was saying something true, as hard as it may be to swallow. Stoicism originated and thrived in times of political instability. People's lives could be upturned at a moment's notice, and death could befall anyone at any age. Even Emperor Marcus Aurelius, who lived at the apogee of Roman power in the century following Epictetus and was strongly influenced by the Greek philosopher, had his share of misfortune. Of his 13 children, only one son and 4 daughters outlived their father, and this was a family that had by far the most material comforts, the best food, and the highest quality medical care the age could afford. Marcus's personal physician was Galen, one of the most famous doctors of antiquity. More to the point, as we have already seen, Epictetus himself adopted a friend's son, saving the boy from what otherwise would have been certain death. So the philosopher clearly had compassion for other people and cared for them, even some not related to him by blood. What Epictetus was telling me then was that it is best to look the reality of life straight in the face, with courage, and that reality includes the fact that no one is immortal. No one is ours in the sense that we are entitled to him or her. Understanding this is not just a way to maintain sanity when a loved one dies or a dear friend leaves for another country. Exile was common then, just as moving for economic reasons or to escape violence and turmoil is now. Facing this reality also reminds us to enjoy the company and love of our fellow humans as much as possible while we can, trying hard not to take them for granted, because it is certain that one day we and they will be gone, and the only right season for appreciating them will have passed. We always live hic et nunc, here and now. The truth of this reality was bluntly shown to me by fate this past summer, when I spent 3 days in Istanbul despite the misgivings of some family members, who had pointed out that the city was the site of a terrible terrorist attack just days before I was to arrive in the country. But I reckoned, correctly as it turned out, that the likelihood of another attack so soon after that one, especially with the predictably heightened security in the aftermath, would make for an acceptably low risk. What I did not take into account, however, was the possibility of political upheaval. One evening I was having dinner with a few friends at a wonderful Cretan restaurant in the historic district of Istanbul when I noticed that everyone at a nearby table, one of the few still occupied so late, was staring intensely into their phones. My immediate interpretation was that I was witnessing yet another example of the damaging effect of modern technology, a preference for checking Facebook over talking to dinner companions. But it soon became clear that I should have denied assent, as the Stoics would say, to that first impression, since these fellow diners were both too engrossed and too visibly concerned for that explanation to be correct. As it turned out, they were following the news that a coup was underway. The reaction at our table was remarkably calm as we finished the wine and kept chatting. My Turkish friends related the history of such events in their country and described the increasingly authoritarian and strongly pro-Islamic government of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. At some point, we had to decide what to do. There were rumors that all bridges had been closed by the military. If true, that would have meant there was no way for us to cross back to our hotel in central Istanbul. As it turned out, only the two bridges on the Bosphorus, connecting the Asian and European sides, were closed. So after failing to find a cab, we cautiously approached the bridge on foot. We saw police cars blocking some streets and curious people hanging around, wondering what to do. The good news was that social media networks were still up. They never went down, in fact. So we could reassure our families that we were okay for now. Indeed, the situation was eerily calm. People fished from the bridge while smoking cigarettes, as they would have done any other night. Puzzled, we reached our hotel and retired for the night. Over the next several hours, we heard helicopters and fighter jets overhead, accompanied at one point by two loud explosions that turned out to come from nearby Taksim Square. But when we woke up in the morning, all appeared to be almost normal, with people in the streets, though not as many as usual, and coffee shops open, though not many museums. The airport hadn't reopened yet, so we kept a low profile, walking the neighborhood and just reading and keeping an eye on the news until we were told that our flight had been changed but was still scheduled to depart. We would be making our way to the airport around midnight, heading for Paris and then New York. And here is where things got a bit more troubling. When we approached the airport in a taxi, the streets were blocked by hundreds of people cheering the failure of the coup, even though the whole thing had left thousands dead or injured, mostly in the capital of Ankara and some smaller cities throughout the country. As a general rule, it is not a good idea to be blocked in traffic in the midst of a frenzied crowd, especially when you don't speak the language. It's even more of a dispreferred indifferent when such a crowd is made up of mostly young men roused by blood that has been shed in their own streets. And you definitely don't want to see your taxi driver starting to shout at another driver out of frustration at not being able to move forward. In spite of these hazards, we eventually made it to the terminal, checked in, and safely flew to Europe, and then to the United States. To a student of Stoicism, the experience was first and foremost a strong reminder of the fundamental principle of this chapter. Few things are under our control. I repeat that principle to myself every day and try to keep it constantly in mind, but there is nothing like a sudden overturn of the social order to forcefully bring the point home. Second, I was surprised at how calmly my companions and I behaved throughout those 24 hours in Istanbul. True, we were never in any apparent physical danger, but the situation was uncertain, and especially once we heard explosions and military planes overhead, a bit of anxiety would not have been entirely out of place. Third, while driving through the chanting crowd at the airport, I was reminded of just how easy it is to manipulate people emotionally, playing on their fears and anger. It reinforced for me the Stoic idea that such emotions should never be given assent, but always kept in check in favor of developing more positive attitudes, such as, in this case, by trying to rationally understand why events were unfolding as they were and where the country was headed as a consequence. In Istanbul, the practice of Stoicism served me well under very unusual circumstances, reinforcing the idea that other people could benefit from it as well, even if they don't find themselves in the midst of a coup d'etat.